Good morning. Good morning, members. Call to order the Senate Jobs and Economic Growth Committee. Nice to have you here, Senator Daley.
It's a great day to be alive, Mr. Chair.
We got three things we're going to try to accomplish today. And the first up is Senate File 225. Senator Peterson, who I've referred to already as a legislative machine, getting things passed on the Senate floor yesterday, heading for the governor's signature. Here comes another one, right, Senator Peterson? Senator Peterson has Senate File 225. He's got some folks with him. I think I'll just turn it over to you, Senator Peterson, for introductory remarks, and then anyone who you would like to have testify on behalf of your legislation.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Before I jump into Senate File 225 here, if you'll allow me some leeway, I just wanted to offer my condolences, I guess, to Senator Scott Newman. You're aware that he represents a small city of Hutchinson, and I think many of you heard this morning that their Hutchinson technology is actually in the next 24 months will be moving anywhere from 600 to 900 jobs from that small community over to Eau Claire, Wisconsin. And so if you see Senator Newman sometime today, he might appreciate you mentioning that and an offer to try and help in any way that we think we can. I'm not sure that there's anything we can do in regards to this jobs committee, but I know it's a sad, sad day for Senator Newman and for the small community of Hutchinson to lose those jobs to Wisconsin. And I just felt compelled to try and mention that.
Yeah, thank you, Senator Peterson. And I thought I saw some mention of that in a press report this morning, and maybe we'll put that in people's packets for either later today or tomorrow's committee hearing, just because you've put a highlight on that. So thank you.
Yeah, I would be grateful, and I think he would, too. The purpose here of Senate 225 and for the chance to share this with you this morning, the purpose of this bill is to make a manufactured home inspection system that we have here in the state of Minnesota more efficient and cost-effective for the consumers and for the state of Minnesota and our residents. This bill specifically authorizes local building officials to inspect manufactured home foundations outside of their city limits. This authority is not mandatory. Yeah, it's just merely permissive. Additionally, this bill clarifies language passed last year on alternative designs for frost-free foundations and would expand the notice of consent form for the sale of used manufactured homes to include multi-section homes and given the consumer's choice in the type of foundation system that best works for their economic situation when the home is being reinstalled in that situation. This bill also makes clear a change requested by the Department of Labor and Industry regarding to the correction to the flame spread rating in the state building code. We have worked with the Department of Labor and Industry on this bill. It has no fiscal cost to the state, and then, at this point we're not aware of any other option or opposition to this bill, which I'm sure you'll confirm towards the end of this hearing. The manufactured home housing is affordable housing, and it's unsubsidized affordable housing that I think we should welcome within our state. I'm very grateful for the chance to carry this bill because it makes our inspection system more efficient and cost-effective, and it means more jobs in my district and I know in your districts around the state of Minnesota. I'm joined by Mr. Mark Bruner today, who was the president of the Minnesota Manufactured Housing Association, and I'm happy to try and address any questions after Mr. Bruner gets a chance to tell you why he's in support of this bill.
So. Good morning, Mr. Bruner. Welcome to the committee, and if you could just identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Mark Bruner. I'm president of the Minnesota Manufactured Housing Association. We have about 400 members in the state, and we represent the builders of manufactured and modular homes, as well as the sale centers and manufactured home communities, installers, and lenders. We have 8 plants that currently build manufactured and modular homes in the state. 4 of the 8 also build manufactured homes. All of them build modular homes. And the difference really is that a A manufactured home is built to the federal building code or the HUD code. Modular homes are built to the state code. Manufactured homes, no matter where they're installed in the state of Minnesota or sold, if it's a code area, a non-code area, are required to be inspected. And currently the way that works is in a code area of Minnesota, the local building official does the inspections, the plan review, that kind of things. In the non-code areas of the state, the Department of Labor and Industry does those inspections. Now, in 2007, you know, we built nearly 4,000 new manufactured homes, or they were installed in the state. You know, this year, the Department of Labor and Industry anticipates about 500 new homes being installed. So what's happened is the sort of the economies of scale in terms of being able to go out to the far reaches of the state in non-code areas has become less cost effective for the department. And what Senator Peterson's bill does is simply allow the local building officials who are currently doing manufactured home inspections in the state, and there are about 500 of them, I believe, to go outside their code area and do those inspections, where currently only the department has the ability to inspect the homes. And we've been working with the department since about January on the language, and there is an amendment to the bill that will get it into the sort of the shape that the department has agreed with us in terms of what's necessary for the bill to work. So on that
point then, Mr. Bruner, Senator Peterson, do you want to present the amendment? I'm guessing it's the A1. And if this is what puts it into the shape that you would like to have it as the author, let's get that in front of the committee.
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, I did notice that the A1 amendment there was copied in on your desks in front of you there before the meeting started. And, yes, they would like to offer this as an amendment relating to specifically, I think, some of the concerns raised by the Department of Labor and Industry.
And maybe I could ask Ms. Doyle to walk through the amendment. It's just basically just one page, but it looks like it hits two or three areas. Could you just describe it,
sure.
And then Senator Peterson follow up?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members. The first change is just a technical change. It's supposed to, it's on line 2.33. It's striking feet, and it's actually a spread rating of 25, not 25 feet. So that one's just a little technical thing. And then it also provides some effective dates that were left as blanks in the original bill. And then Section 4 of the bill in the amendment on line 1.8, this is the section that Senator Peterson just discussed about that would allow the local municipalities to review the do the inspections, and otherwise they would have been done by Dolly in the past. And then Section 5, it talks about fees, and it says that in the non-code areas that the fees just have to be the same as in the areas with the state building code, and that third-party vendors can charge their normal rates for the inspections. And then we're deleting a couple of sections that were in the bill, and basically the sections that are being deleted are covered now by these two new sections that we're adding back into the bill. We're also eliminating Section 7 in the bill that talks about dispute resolution. And so I think other than the dispute resolution, the other two areas are addressed in the amendment.
Thank you, Ms. Doyle. Senator Peterson, to the amendment. Any more follow-up to describe the amendment? It sounded like there had been some work with Dolly, with the department. So either you or Mr. Bruner, do you want to speak to that?
I don't have anything unless Mr. Bruner.
Okay, Mr. Bruner.
Mr. Chairman, yes. What the amendment does, and when the bill was drafted, the intent of the department was to no longer essentially administer the federal inspection program, and the department intent now is after Commissioner Peterson and his team took a look at the program, that their intent is to continue administering the program. So with respect to the fee section going away in the bill, the department will continue to retain the $80 seal fee that otherwise they would have had to forego in terms of administering the program or actually doing the inspection on behalf of HUD. It also eliminates a dispute resolution program. Last year, the legislature put in place a dispute resolution program for residential contractors. If there's a problem with a homeowner and an ability to work with the department, had Dolly not continued to administer the federal program, the intent was that any manufactured home disputes would be resolved in that capacity. However, there is currently and has been for a few years already a program in place at Dolly to handle disputes with purchasers of manufactured home that's required under the federal building code. So that's the reason that that part of the bill is being changed. And then finally, the language just simply clarifies that a local building official may do the inspections. There was some concern that perhaps it could have been read otherwise, that a local building official would be required to do the inspections outside of their code area. So the language simply clarifies that they may do the inspections outside of their area.
So Senator Peterson moves the A1. Members, we have a quorum for purposes of this bill and the remainder of the committee. Senator Kielash, to the amendment.
Yes, to the amendment. Just could you give me a little more clarification on what kind of fees would be a reasonable estimate of total fees for the installer or the new homeowner? Because it's kind of – because you changed it from a number to current or whatever it is. I just don't know those numbers.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, Senator Kielash, currently there's an $80 fee. So the $80 fee is kept, that's paid to the department. Beyond that, there's there are fees in place that the city would use currently for inspecting the manufactured homes. They might do a plan review, that may be $100, $200. There would be any travel time involved, that kind of thing. So it simply just keeps in place that fee structure that's currently there, and if there's a great deal of work, if they have to go back three or four times to do the inspection, then that time would be charged for as well under the current structure.
Just Senator Kielash.
Yeah, so depending on where the home is being placed is where the fees could be varied from one county or one city to the next?
Sure.
Okay. I mean, yeah. Just trying to clarify that. So,
Mr. Bruner.
Okay, thanks.
Yes.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is on the bill itself, not the amendment. Is this appropriate time to speak to the bill, or do you want to wait till we pass the amendment?
Let's take care of the amendment first, Senator Nelson, then I will recognize you. So, members, any more discussion or follow-up on the A1? Senator Peterson has moved that we adopt the A1. All in favor say aye.
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 All opposed say same sign. Amendment is adopted. Okay, we have the A1 in front of us. On to Senate File 225. Senator Nelson.
I have a question on Section 3, page 4, about lines, starting with line 6. And can you tell me what the significance is of striking the words single section? So when we're talking about manufactured homes, why are you wanting to strike the words single section? I don't know what that means exactly.
Sure.
Mr. Bruner.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Nelson, last year the legislature updated the state building code to allow in situations where the home was originally, the manufactured home required to be on a frost-free foundation system because of the requirements of the federal building code.
Mm-hmm.
So that if the homeowner elected when that home was relocated, 18 months, 2 years later after it was sold, that they could, rather than have it placed on a frost-free foundation at some point, which might cost $8,000-$10,000, the home might have a value of, perhaps $20,000 if it's an older home. So it allowed the consumer the ability to set it to the state building code standard for above frost line installation. And what the bill does this year is allow the owner of a manufactured home that might be a two-section manufactured home, that same ability going forward if the home is relocated.
Just a follow-up.
Is that anyone else?
So the manufactured home that's not multi-section is not eliminated from that?
No.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Pearson, do you have more witnesses that you want to hear from or any other testimony you want to get in front of the committee at this point?
Mr. Chair and members, we do not, other than, like I said, we are not aware of any opposition to this, but I think you confirmed you're gonna double-check that.
So at this point, members and anyone in the room here, is there anyone who'd like to testify for or against Senate File 225? And, Senator Pearson, I have the advantage of right in my line of sight, I can see the other Pearson, Ken, the commissioner, and his
department. The good-looking one.
the other one. And I'm
they're both good-looking.
I'm looking for a thumbs up. there you go. For the record, I have a thumbs up from Commissioner Pearson as to this legislation. I see you have some questionable co-sponsors, Senator Pearson, but otherwise...
They're pretty strong. Lily and I were just talking about
otherwise,
that.
Otherwise, it's
Chair.
Looking pretty good.
Got a lot of strength behind this one.
It's looking pretty good. So, members, I think we're ready to
Can
act.
I have a... Mr. Chairman, just a question to Mr. Bruner. Do you know, with these 4,000 new homes introduced in manufactured homes in Minnesota, where are they manufactured? Do we know that? Are they some built in our state?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, Senator Metzen, the plants that are building manufactured homes in the state, and they tend to be the larger employers in the towns, are Redwood Falls, Montevideo, Red Lake Falls, and Worthington.
That Mr. Chairman, that's good news to know that they're built and made in our state, putting people to work and paying taxes.
Thank you, Senator Metzen. All right, so Senator Pearson moves that Senate File 225 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Finance Committee. To that motion, members? All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, same sign. Bill is passed. Thank you, Senator Pearson. Thank you, Mr. Bruner. Members, we're all about quick changes of pace here in this committee, and let's see, today's Tuesday. At the end of last week, beginning of this week, we had some new jobs and economic numbers, and so we wanted to ask Mr. Hine to join us again. He was in here a couple weeks ago with a PowerPoint, and so, Mr. Hine, we're not looking for a PowerPoint, we're not looking for a full session from you, but if you could maybe just give the committee an update, the numbers, I guess at least the press coverage of it was a mix. And we'd love to get your interpretation numbers and specifically what it means for Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thanks for the chance to come back. It was just about a month ago I was here with my PowerPoints in a more lengthy discussion. So I'm happy to come back in with a brief update. A lot has happened within the last month.
And Mr. Hine, let me just set up. So just for members, we don't have anything in your packet on this unless Mr. Hine has some kind of a handout, but we kind of asked him just within the last 48 hours to talk specifically about the latest release of statistics. So if you're looking for something, you're not going to find anything. So, Mr. Hine, you have our undivided attention.
Thank you. And sharpened pencils.
Yes.
Good. within the last month, we have had a release of revisions to our employment and unemployment data for the last couple years. In terms of jobs, the result of that revision was that 2009 wasn't quite as bad as we had previously announced, but 2010 wasn't as good. From peak to trough, the Great Recession produced 158,000 jobs lost rather than 162,000, so there was a slight improvement there. But the rebound since we hit bottom in September 2009 has netted only a gain of 19,000 jobs rather than the 33,000 that we had previously announced through December. Simultaneously with the release of these revisions, we also announced that January's employment was up by a net of 2,000 jobs, while the unemployment rate slipped further to 6.7%. This matches the rate that we last saw in December of 2008 and is now nearly 2 points lower than the revised high of 8.5% that we saw in May and June of 2009. Also last month, we released the results of our fourth quarter round of what we call our job vacancy survey. Overall, the number of estimated vacancies rose from a year earlier by 30.6%, nearly a third, to 33,800. This, in combination with diminished unemployment, has reduced the number of job seekers per vacancy to 5.8 from 8.2 a year earlier. Which is a distinct improvement, but a far cry from the roughly 2 job seekers per vacancy that we tended to see before the recession hit. It was also a good sign that 18 of the 22 major occupational groups and 17 of the 20 major industrial sectors improved over the year. So the improvement was significant, but also broadly spread across the economy, which is always a positive sign as well. On a related measure, the Conference Board released February data on their Help Wanted online. I had a chart last month showing the distinct improvement there. Again, Minnesota showed improvement in February over the previous month, even though the national number declined slightly. And by their measure, we still rank 10th in the nation in terms of the number unemployed per vacancy. That is 10th best in the nation. National employment and unemployment data for February was also released last week. This is what the Senator Michelle was referring to. Contained the strongest job numbers that we've seen since the second quarter of last year, before we went into a bit of a soft spot throughout the last half of last year. There were 222,000 private sector jobs added, a total of 192,000 jobs. The national unemployment rate also slipped another tenth to 8.9. That's now nearly a full point below where it was in November at 9.8. And in that time, 1.4 million Americans have left the ranks of the unemployed. Also last week, the U.S. Department of Labor announced that the 4-week moving average of new claims for unemployment benefits fell below the 400,000 mark. A threshold that's often used to demark job growth from job loss. And it's the first time we've seen that since before the recession hit. I noted last month that Minnesota fell below 25,000 per month by a similar measure. Although it did spike again in January, there's indications that was weather-related, and we're hopeful that February's numbers will show us returning back to something below that 25,000 a month threshold. All in all, this past month has been very favorable in terms of indicators of our current economic trajectory. However, we remain mindful of the fragility of this recovery and how far we have to go to full employment. In the past month, for example, unrest in the Mideast has jacked up gas prices by about 15%, and it was announced also within the last month that the Case-Shiller Home Price Index dropped another 3.9%. And, of course, federal, state, and local fiscal situations remain uncertain. Despite the gains recently, 6 million Americans, that's 44% of all unemployed, have been unemployed for over 26 weeks. And the average duration of spells hit another high of just over 37 weeks. Despite our job gains, we're still below October 1999 levels and 137,000 jobs below our pre-recessionary peak. Despite falling below 200,000 unemployed Minnesotans after peaking above a quarter million, at least that many, again, are still underemployed or have fallen off from the tally by discontinuing job search. So in a nutshell, we seem to be moving in the right direction with increased confidence that the recovery is gaining momentum, but significant risks remain, and we have a long way to go to get back to where we want to be.
Thank you, Mr. Hine. And just one follow-up. Well, so far one follow-up. and you touched on this, but the growing number of, I'm sure there's some better economic terms, but kind of disenchanted, or those who are just literally not, they've decided they're not going to look for jobs anymore.
Yeah.
And I recall one of
discouraged workers.
Discouraged, discouraged, disenchanted.
Mm-hmm. I'll suggest that as a change.
Thank you. Any more information on that? I recall one of your graphs had it was a scary graph that had multiple layers and colors of how we count our jobless figures, our unemployment figures, and some are suggesting that, well, yeah, the unemployment rate has gone down, but that's basically due, or much of that is due to the fact that just fewer people have decided to look for jobs now. And yeah. I don't know if you've got a little more detail on that, Mr. Hine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We do on the national level. The number of discouraged workers has fallen off from about 1.5 million a year ago when it was at or about its peak to in January just under 1 million. It went up a bit, but a relatively small amount to just over 1 million in February. So the trend is not worsening. As with the other measures of unemployment, including the part-time workers that want to work full-time, we are seeing slow but steady improvement in those measures. I will say that the 1.4 million decline in the unemployed, about half of that, about 700,000 of that, was due to departures from the labor force. It doesn't appear in the discouraged worker measure. So there are other reasons that people may discontinue job search. Half of it was due to employment gains, the re-employment of those unemployed individuals.
And then, Mr. Hine, for benefits of this committee, we're at the second week of March here. Any more releases, reports, in the next month or two that we should pay special attention to?
Sure, Mr. Chair.
Mr.
We'll be releasing our February state employment and unemployment data next Thursday. And, of course, the first Friday of every month is the release of the national data. As I looked at the underlying data that the raw data that produced that 2,000 job gain in January, I honestly feel that the raw data there was much stronger than it translated into after seasonal adjustment. So I'll be watching next week's release carefully to see signs that we are seeing better job growth than that 2,000 gain in January suggests. And then we'll be watching the national release carefully to see signs that this 200,000-plus job growth that we saw for the first time in 8 months continues into the future. If this was a one-time aberration, we're going to be looking at much worse conditions down the road rather than much better.
Senator Tomasoni, did you have your hand up?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you said there's a group that haven't been able to find work for like 37 months. Did I hear you say something like that?
Senator Tomasoni, the average duration of unemployment spells is up to 37 weeks.
Okay. 37 weeks.
Right.
Okay. And is there any indication of a predominant sector of the economy that they're coming from where they lost their jobs and they're not able to find new jobs, or is it all over the board?
Senator Tomasoni, The strength that we're seeing is broad-based. The weakness that we have seen, if you look back over 3 years, throughout the downturn, certainly some areas like construction have been hardest hit. Some areas like healthcare have done fairly well. But we are seeing challenges in re-employing those that have lost their jobs pretty much across the board.
Maybe a follow-up to that. So are we finding so healthcare is a sector where they're getting jobs back. Is high tech another place where they're finding new jobs? Or are people having to retrain to get new jobs? Or are they able to find, this is kind of a question that's all-encompassing, but mm-hmm. are they able to find jobs in their were they in their previous industry, or are they having to retrain to find jobs, or what's going on exactly? Do we know that, or can't we tell?
Yeah, Senator Tosoni, I do look at the movement of individuals from one industry to the next. Surprisingly, construction workers, although you would think based on the net employment change and the dramatic declines that we've been seeing there, many of them are finding reemployment. We do see a lot of people...
reemployment outside of construction?
Moving into other areas... outside of construction, for example. Many of them, and this is across the board, not just in the construction sector, are going through the channel of temp help agencies these days. We see a dramatic increase over 3 or 4 years ago of the number of people that are laid off in one industry finding their initial reemployment in that temp help sector. In some areas, it was... upwards of 10% of those that are laid off found their first job within temp help.
Just people getting really desperate? Is that what that is?
Well, I think if the average duration is 37 weeks, you know, a desperation certainly can play a factor, yeah.
Mr. Hine, I appreciate you giving us an update and serving as a good source of information.
I appreciate the chance to come in. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. If I could ask... Commissioner Peterson, then, and the Department of Labor and Industry to join us. Members, I think virtually every committee hearing between now and the end of March, we will at some point or another be talking about the budget. Today we're going to have the Department of Labor and Industry go through their budget overview with us. And I'm not sure if you're doing that through a high-tech presentation, Mr. Peterson, or... however you'd prefer, but welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. We will be trying to do the high tech, and if that fails, we'll just go back to reading. We have circulated this document from the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry. It's just sort of a summary of our budget.
Mr. Chairman.
Hang on, Mr. Peterson. Senator Cohen.
Just understand what we're doing. So we're working off of this. Not the real budget pages? Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cohen, yes, we'd like to work off this to give you an overview of where we're going, what we have going. Our budget changes are pretty small.
Well, Mr. Chairman, is that how we're going to do the budget, working off the eighth grade version?
Senator Cohen.
What are we going to do?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Are we going to work off of the eighth grade versions of these budgets, or are we going to work off the budget pages?
I think we go from eighth grade all the way into master's work with Commissioner Peterson here, so... Senator Metzen.
Mr. Chairman, I think Senator Cohen is right on. We've been here for a couple of months and have not heard any numbers yet, so to speak of...
I hope we'll hear them today.
But, I mean, in all the facets of our committee structure here, we got to start getting into money pretty soon, I would think.
Senator Cohen, you've got the budget book right in front of you, so you have all the materials and all the details in that blue binder, and we've asked... Commissioner Peterson to go through the budget today. If you have specific questions for him, that's why he's here. So we can go to whatever level detail that would comfort you, and I think that's what we should be doing.
Well, Mr. Chairman, let me just figure out how we're going to operate.
Senator Cohen.
The budgets are going to be out in, 2 weeks? Is that correct, from this committee? The budget bills will be out in 2 weeks?
Senator Cohen, we have two things going on at once. As you know. So we have the governor's budget, which has recommendations for each of the agencies that this committee has jurisdiction for. So we're trying to get an understanding of what's in the governor's budget. I guess roughly at the same time, we will be developing a legislative budget. So we're going to have to be able to walk and chew gum at the same time. And so we have not had – we've had Commissioner Peterson in here to talk about himself and his agency, but he's not been here to present his budget. So that was the hope for today's committee.
And Mr. Chairman, that's my concern. We've had a lot of hearings since the session started, the overview hearings, which are kind of the legislative equivalent of show and tell, where everybody comes in and tells us how wonderful they are. and so I'm curious – you know, it's your committee. normally in the past, the labor and industry budget usually has taken three or four committee hearings to go through. So I take it we're just going to spend an hour or so on each department? Is that what you're – I mean, are we going to have meetings this weekend or what?
We've had – Senator Cohen, there's been no commitment to any particular amount of time other than the right amount of time. And, again, I want to make sure that Commissioner Peterson has the ability to present what he wants to present in his way. I'm sure we will have all kinds of follow-up and individual members will have questions about it. But that's why he's here today. Senator Lilly.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cohen, I do have notes in my binder here from conversations we had at our meetings last week, which I believe, as I recall, you were not present for those conversations.
Out of town.
So we have started the process of going through our binder, going through our budgets at that level. My expectation is that today we will hear more, and as has happened in other committees that you and I share, we've both talked about what's on the flip note copy and also what's in the book. So I'm assuming that we'll be doing both of those today also.
Okay. Commissioner Peterson,
Mr.
you
Chair,
have the floor.
Just on the same lines.
Senator Kielash, will this be helpful for our
It kind of goes along with Senator Cohen's comments about – I'm just wondering if we're going to have time to hear the individual bills that are related to these departments that have been introduced prior to the budget time. So, you know, bills that are in for the – for different organizations, for funding, et cetera. I'm not sure how you're planning. Just wonder if you could give us an idea how that's going to work.
We heard, Senator Kielash, we heard a bill just prior to this that that involved the Department of Labor and Industry. So I think the answer is yes, we will continue to work in that fashion. We've got a mix of budget and policy and multiple state agencies, and so we want to give everyone some time at the microphone with the committee, and I'm certainly open to suggestions as to how we calendar that out. Mm-hmm. So appreciate that.
Thanks.
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, members, on there are two things you should have. One is this document, with the change items, that's page 7 through 15. I would like to go – then we have the major document they'll be using on the just to start out, to give you a brief overview of our budget. The change items will come last. We'll explain those. Change items are greatly significant. They're not a big change from last year. But I would like just to give you a sense of what our budget consists of, where the spending goes, where the revenues come from, where the spending goes. And I'll try to do that as quickly as possible to accommodate your questions about the change items. First of all, the first PowerPoint I have, I think, is like page 4 from your book. Just our revenues by fund. As you can see, the Department of Labor and Industry gets we have very little general fund revenues. Most of it is fee generated. It comes from an assessment on workers' comp insurers. Comes from fees paid to the construction boards, some federal funds, and then special revenue coming from the workforce development funds. So those are our chief areas. If you go to the next, our expenditures, as you can see, our the biggest single expenditure we have in the department does not go to operations, but rather it goes to workers' comp benefits. That's about $140 million per biennium. Those are chiefly for two benefits that were terminated in 1996, but still our workers who were injured before that time are entitled to them. They're called supplemental benefits and second injury benefits. There's also in that work comp benefits is also the uninsured employers fund. So 54% of our money, of the funds that go into the department, basically go out in benefits. Then our the second largest area is the construction codes area. As you know, we've got five construction boards within the department, and they assess fees for a variety of licenses, permits, and that sort of thing. And that basically funds the work of the agency. There are no general funds that go into that. That accounts for $25 million a year, $50 million per biennium. Then the workers' comp It's our next largest section, workers' comp. OSHA amounts to $45 million per biennium, or 18% of their budget. That pays for the workers' comp section. That is the area that supervises and regulates the operations of work comp in the state, and also provides for OSHA, for the state contribution to the OSHA programs, the Occupational Safety and Health programs. We have two OSHA programs. One is compliance. The other is consultation. We pay for 10% of the consultation, 50% of the compliance. The federal government pays for the remainder. So those are basically where our funds come from, how our, let's overview how our funds are expended and where they come from. If the next chart is just another breakdown of some of the same, there's not another way of looking at it. That is that out of our, just this for next year, out of our 2012 expenditures, you'll see that 30% across the top, 30% or $39 million, $35.5 million will go to internal operations, 70% go outside of the agency. And the external operations are listed below there. There's a grant to the Rehabilitation Center at Vinland for $200,000, benefit claims for injured workers, $70 million, and then we fund the Workers' Comp Court of Appeals, part of the Office of Administrative Hearings for their judges. $750,000 goes to the Department of Commerce for fraud investigations, and MMB gets $100,000 for their work. Then we have two programs for safety. One are just general safety grants. That amounts to almost $1 million. And the loggers rebates, a 20-year-old program, $720,000. The construction codes and licensing, you can see we have a contractor.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, I thought the logger rebate program was going to be phased out.
Mr. Peterson.
I've not heard that. Senator Cohen, Mr. Chairman, that the loggers still like the program. They admire it. They do like it. I've not seen any phasing out of it.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, how does the cost compare to where it was 10 years ago, 5 years ago? Do you know?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cohen, it's my understanding it's been about the same.
Okay.
It's been a good program. The workers' comp cost for the logging industry was almost driving out of business 20 years ago. This program has kept logging in Minnesota and kept those jobs in Minnesota. It's basically the money that they get assessed for and they get back. The contractor recovery fund is a fund set up paid for out of contractor fees that goes to people who get a court judgment against a contractor who is not not delivered what they promised to do in their residential construction. Basically, if you get a judgment against a contractor for a residential building, then you sue, then you get paid for it. And that's been done in conjunction with the contractor community. Then,
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Metz.
Just a question on that contractor's recovery fund. We haven't rated that or anything, have we, to balance the budget?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Benson, no. That fund has not been rated. That's been a very worthwhile fund, and I think the contractor community.
Mr. Chairman, I understand it's worthwhile and what it does, but I think we've overstepped in some other areas around here. But I'm glad this is where it's supposed to be.
This is where it's, we have maybe. Yeah.
Thank you.
Before I put my finger on the next one is $7.1 million that goes to hiring contract electrical inspectors. Particularly in the outstate area, we rely on contracting electrical inspectors who are, or people who almost work full-time providing inspectors, but they are they're private contractors. And so what we're able to do with them is work goes down, they receive less as work goes up, they make more money. We anticipate spending $7.1 million on them for the next year.
Question, Mr. Chair.
Sorry, Senator Howe.
Mr. Chair. There was just a recent news article on a local TV station about the fund for electrical contractors or inspections. Can you speak to that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Howe, we'll get to that later, but I can talk to it right now if you'd like. What that is, and this is what Senator, I think what you're referring to is what Senator Metzen also referred to. That is, over the last number of years, money has been taken out of some of the fees that contractors pay and other licensee electricians and others pay, and then that has gone into the general fund. Last 2 years, it's been 1.5 million per year. Previous years, it's been much higher. You can see at the end of the materials, we have a listing of that, and we can go into more detail when we get there, Senator Hall.
All right, thank you,
Mr. Peters.
So those are our expenditures. The Workers' Compensation Fund, we used to be called the special, this is the next page. That's basically where we get money, the funds that go that are assessed against the insurance companies and employers. As you can see, supplementary benefits counts for $100 million per biennium for approximately 3,000 claimants. Second injuries benefits are $21 million. Those two are the ones that were terminated in 1996. So over time, they will become less and less as recipients die off. But we do anticipate continue to pay those out until sometime in 2045 or 2050, depending on expanse of individuals. Then we pay $19 million a year goes out in employees of uninsured and bankrupt self-insured employers. And the cost of administering the workers' compensation program and OSHA at Labor and Industries, $48 million. The cost of the other activities at OEH, 14.5, the Workers' Compensation Court of Appeals, $3.4 million. Department of Commerce, $1.5 million. MMB, $200,000. So that's just another way of looking at it. We've just looking at the numbers I just gave you. For the workers' the next page, the Workers' Compensation Division. There, the Workers' Compensation section or operations cost $21,914,000 per year. We have 121 employees work in that section. With OSHA compliance, we have.
Mr. Chairman, why did you draw the committee's attention to this OSHA violation on the lower left here? Well, that's about as dangerous as a photos I've ever seen.
Commissioner Peterson, right behind you right now is a picture of a very interesting picture with a guy, I don't know,
boy,
100 feet below a huge crane.
Look at the guy.
Good thing he's got that hard head. Senator Metzen's a little worried about that.
Hard head's not going to help much when it collapses.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Metzen, you brought this up the last time we appeared before you, and we're still trying to get him out of there.
Mr. Chairman,
we've had ropes down there. We haven't been able to get him out yet.
That helmet's not going to help much when it collapses.
Seriously, Mr. Chairman, Senator Metzen, this is a type of work that OSHA does. We had three or four people die per year in the collapse of trenches like this. And so highly dangerous work. We're just trying to show the type of work we do. And hopefully the fellow made it out.
Thank you.
I said the OSHA compliance costs $16.5 million per biennium. Then we have work by that. We pay for 50%. I'm sorry, the state of Minnesota pays for 50% of that, and the federal government pays for 50% of that. We don't know what will happen on the federal level, but if there will be cuts in OSHA or not, I guess as we find out more, we'll report to you what we need to do about that.
Senator Kielash.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Peterson, can you break it down by how many of these employees are working in compliance and how many are working in whatever?
Consultation. Yeah. 85, Mr. Chairman, Senator Kielash, 85 are working in compliance, 16 are working in consultation. There are about 35 of those people are actual inspectors. The others do backup work of various types, training and other things. That. Here's just another, what I have on the screen right now is simply another way of looking at, we've already talked about the various funds, how we're spending our money. As you can see, if you look at the bottom, the financing by fund in the Workers' Compensation Division is $176 million is done through workers' compensation assessments, $10 million from the federal government, that is through OSHA, and $62,000 special revenue funds. The next division that we have, the other one that's fee generating, is construction codes and licensing. There, the governor has called for $50 million in the budget, basically out of generated by fees and licenses. One-third of that budget is related to electrical inspections. We have, as you can see, we have 112 employees in that division, in addition to 83 independent electrical contractors, electrical inspection contractors. If you go down there, you can see the construction codes and licensing. You can see the areas we work in, building codes and standards, residential building contractors, electrical license inspectors, plumbing and engineering, boilers, high-pressure piping systems, boats for hire, independent contractor certification. The next screen is simply the total budget. It's fairly simple, $50 million that we get. The special revenue funds of $7 million. The special revenue funds referring to that contractor recovery fund that I addressed earlier. Labor standards and apprenticeship are the only areas, or labor standards is the only area where you get general funds that come into the department. We have, the governor has recommended total budget for the biennium is $1.7 million. The governor has recommended a 5% cut in that area, which we'll be talking about in a minute. But this is the area that does labor employment laws, minimum wage, overtime, child labor laws, prevailing wage, and employee rights. And this is an area that answers a lot of phone calls, lots of emails, lots of visits from people trying to find out their rights. And we also do go out and do inspections. In the apprenticeship area, the next one is we have six employees there. They regulate and supervise various apprenticeship programs throughout the state. This is funded through the Workforce Development Fund from the Department of Employment and Economic Development. Final page, labor standards and apprenticeship. That just sums up the general fund, $1.7 million, and $2.2 comes from the Workforce Development Fund. So the total budget in that area is $4 million. Mr. Chairman, those are the areas of our budget. I guess we have one more, just the general support division. This pays for our computer people, lawyers, human resources, accountants, and others. And you can see that those are funded from appropriate shares taken from the Workers' Compensation Division and from the construction codes and licensing area, as well as some from the federal money that comes through OSHA. Amounts of $18 million per biennium.
Chairman.
Senator Metzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was looking at the commissioner on the labor standards, and sounds like you do 98% of the work over the phone system. you'd think you should be out at the sites at the checking on minimum wage or overtime or prevailing wage. Are you comfortable doing this investigations by email and phone calls? Shouldn't you be out there in the trenches and looking at this stuff?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Metzen, we do spend some time out in the field investigating issues. At the same time, we are able to collect a lot of information through phone calls, emails, and that sort of thing. We'd like to have higher funding, no question about it. We also recognize the realities of that are facing you in the general fund. We understand that.
Okay.
I want to be clear that one of the worst things that can happen if you call a government agency and no one answers. That's one of the most frustrating things. When I started this job, one gentleman told me that he said the problem with that Department of Labor and Industry, you got an empty room over there. It's got a table and it's got a phone on it, and no one ever goes in and answers that phone. And so I told him I'd try to find that room as well as that phone and make sure someone's answering it. And like we have done a better job of answering phones, taking care of those. But that is one of the worst, most frustrating things you can have when you call a government agency is to have no one answer, or you sit in those queues the last 5 to 10 minutes. I hope that doesn't happen in our department.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Peterson, to follow up in regard to Senator Metzen's question, I agree with you in regard to the phone, and my sense is that most of the enforcement activities that you do are complaint-based and that the residents and workers are taking responsibility for their own rights and probably not calling you unless there's a problem. Could you speak to that for a few
minutes? Mr. Chairman, Senator Peterson, you're absolutely correct.
Okay.
We don't have – there's no way we could afford to go out and inspect every work site to make sure they comply with our various laws. It is – our inspections are driven by complaints. An individual says they're not getting paid the minimum wage.
Thank you.
Or an individual says they're not getting the proper rest breaks, that sort of thing. Then we look into it and follow up on it. So it is an area where the individual employees do contact us if they feel they have a problem. Now, there may be some employees are intimidated, but I don't think we could do any other way of approaching it. There's simply too many workplaces in Minnesota.
Senator Thomason.
Chairman. Commissioner. Senator Metzen and I often talk about this in regards to whenever somebody introduces a bill that requires some kind of a work by a department, that the department comes back and says, I need $150,000 to hire a couple of people. And we always wonder why, when you have 400 or 500 people in your agency, why you can't just give the job to somebody that's there. And one of the things that I think that's been happening in Dolly is that prevailing wage complaints have gotten pretty high, and the former commissioner said they didn't have the staff to go out and investigate the prevailing wage complaints. And so I'm wondering, is there a way for you to move staff around to actually be able to or increase workload, I suppose, of staff that you have there without having to hire new people to be able to handle the complaints and the various phone calls and emails that are coming in that might require somebody going out into the field to take a look at something.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Tomasoni, because this is an area that is the only area that's funded through the general fund, that we have limits on the flexibility of moving people in and out of this area, because the other large parts of the department are funded through fees. So the individuals who work in those areas, if you're getting a license for an electrical contractor, you want to make sure that money goes simply to the people that work on electrical contractor issues or work on construction issues. That it's a fee for service approach, and so it's hard to move people from that division into labor standards as a consequence. And so we do not have the type of flexibility we'd like. Same time, if we have complaints, we have legitimate complaints, we'll do everything we can do to investigate them.
Mr. Chairman, do you need legislation to be able to be flexible, or is that something you can do already if you want to?
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Tomasoni, we are required to keep two people on prevailing wage right now, I think. And so I don't think we need legislation. I just don't think it's appropriate. We can handle it.
How about legislation to be flexible? In other words, can you take somebody from another part that's in the electrical codes and use them in prevailing wage if you want to, or do you have to have specific legislation in order to be able to do that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Tomasoni, I believe we'd have to have special legislation to do that.
Senator Peterson.
Mr. Chair, to follow up on Senator and Commissioner Peterson, is that an accurate statement to say that prevailing wage complaints are increasing? You know, I'm curious about that because we have a severe decline in construction. I find that I cannot believe that those complaints are increasing, as Senator Tomasoni suggests, when our construction economy is so depressed.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Peterson. I don't know the numbers.
Okay.
Intuitively, I'd agree with you. I haven't looked at the numbers.
Senator Peterson.
Follow up. In regard to those complaints on prevailing wage, do you track where those complaints come from, or are those anonymous? Do they come from the people actually working on that job, or do they come out from outside of the job?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Peterson, they can't be anonymous. They have to come from people working on the job.
Thank you.
We have to follow up. We can't have someone just call them and say, Joe's not paying Sam enough money. Instead, we have to give their names, when they worked there, what their situation was, and they have to provide the payroll information to us, too.
Thank you.
Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, can we have some discussion on the change item requests you're making?
Yeah, we'll, I want to do that right now.
Okay, I wasn't quite sure if we were just kind of skipping around or what we were doing. So.
I think that's the next page.
Okay, the next page, change item presentations. The first one is a 5% reduction. The first one you'll see in the sheet and on the screen is a 5% reduction. The governor's requested a 5% reduction in the labor standards section. And that, as you can see, that would result in a reduction of 0.5 a labor investigator and result in some delays in responses. And we'd expect to respond to 100 fewer complaints, answer 25 fewer phone calls, and 300 fewer emails. You know, these, I want to be clear, these are the best we can do coming up with estimates. We're not quite sure how many actual fewer phone calls we'll be able to handle. It will take us longer to get to those phone calls. The more you reduce it, the longer it takes to get the phone calls. No question about it.
Senator,
Mr. Chairman, the commissioner, there's a little bit of a contradiction. You talked about the concern with people calling, not having telephone calls answered. Response to Senator Peterson, you know, expressed your concern about what you're attempting to do with the agency, but then we make this small general fund cut and we accentuate that. Seems a little bit contradictory to what you'd like to do with the agency in terms of being more responsive to the public.
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cohen, what we'd like to do with the agency is to do as well as we could, answer complaints, handle complaints the best we could. At the same time, we recognize the situation that the budget's in. So we're agreeing with the 5% budget cut the governor's proposed.
You know, Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, I recognize that obviously with limited general fund dollars, if we're going to look at a deficit of $6 billion, $5 billion for the general fund, obviously you've got to look for general fund dollars to cut. You don't have a lot of that in the agency. But again, we've had a lot of discussion in this committee about a lack of response, whether it be permitting, complaints, whatever. I think, Mr. Chairman, that's how you started out the committee hearings this session, were concerns expressed by some of the business organizations that state government over the last several years had not been responsive to citizens for whatever purpose they were trying to utilize the state government. So I hope as we proceed, I got to recognize you have the particular problem that you don't have a lot of general fund dollars to work with, that we can try to minimize what apparently has been the problem of state government over the last several years, at least as expressed in the original committee hearings in this committee.
Mr. Peterson, why don't you keep going through these?
I just went through the first change item, which is a 5% budget cut to labor standards. The next one would be, this goes to what Senator Howell brought up earlier. This is the continuation of a surcharge of $5 per transaction with the building permits with the state. And this would generate $1.2 million per year, $22.4 million over the next 2 years. This idea was brought to us by businesses who are the contractors who are regulated by by the division, in light of the $1.5 million that was taken out of the construction fund and given to the general fund. So this is 1.2 is meant to replace, although it's not quite enough, but it's meant to replace the $1.5 million that was taken out and that's dedicated to the general fund. It does exist in law now, and we're just asking that it be renewed for the next 2 years.
And, Mr. Peterson, so that surcharge was just put into law last year, is that right?
Yes, in 2010.
And so the proposal is to extend that for the next two-year?
Yes, yes.
Next two budget, okay. Questions on that, members? Senator Howell.
Mr. Chair, can you speak? I think part of that discussion, you know, obviously they were talking about how the general fund or how that money had been taken from the inspection division. But I think there was also part of that where the inspectors were complaining about getting reimbursed or their payments being timely. And I'm wondering if you could speak to that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Howell, you know, I saw that in the newspaper. or it was a newspaper or else TV, that someone mentioned they had been paid 2 months late or something. We couldn't find that. We have tried to make people that they get payments within within 2 weeks of the time they submit their receipts. We would hope that if there are people who are not getting paid in a timely fashion, they have not contacted us. So one individual did tell the press that he was not getting paid. We did not find evidence of that. However, if there are people who are not, we're not saying it couldn't happen. If they are not getting paid on time, we'd like to hear about it. Make sure they do get paid on time. It's deplorable.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Peterson, for that response.
Senator Kielash.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Peterson, is the $1.2 million an estimate of the amount that's going to be made we're going to get? And if the construction industry picks up, will that be greater, or is this just hoping for the best as far as funding goes?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kielash, that's based on level activity going on today.
Okay. So increase.
So if it does goes higher, we'll presumably get more funds. If it goes lower, we won't get as much.
Okay. Thanks.
And so, Mr. Peterson, is it your testimony, you know, based on the work that you've put into this, that those who are charged this surcharge or fee have agreed to this extension? Mr. Peterson?
Mr. Chairman, members, contractor groups have recommended it. So the businesses have recommended it. Now, not every homeowner has to pay the permit, or every individual has to pay it ultimately. Certainly hasn't agreed to it. But the groups representing the involved contractors who are concerned about not getting inspections done in time do favor it. Mr. Chairman, they've not been happy over the last number of years since we've been taking the money, the dedicated fee money, and turning it into a general fund. There's been a certain amount of unhappiness on that issue. But they also recognize some of the realities of the situation, and so they proposed a surcharge, and we think it's a good way of dealing with the problem. It's not the best way, but it does deal with the problem. A relatively low cost to each payer.
Senator Lilly.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Peterson. Tying together the presentation PowerPoint to the budget book, on page 31 of the Department of Labor Industry, it lists the budget for construction codes and services, but also has the full-time equivalents. And it looks like the full-time equivalents are going up about 10% for that area, from about 130 to 129 to 140 or so. At this time, where the construction industry is at a lower level than its past, what is the reasoning behind increasing the number of inspectors or the number of staff in the construction codes and the services area?
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Lilly, part of the answer is we do anticipate the construction activity, which I'll be touching on in just a minute. We do anticipate construction activity picking up. We're not sure how much. We're getting more building permits than we had in the past. We have more building plans submitted to us over the last few months. We do anticipate more activity. At the same time, those numbers that you referenced on page whatever it was, we're withdrawing those, which I'll get to in the next page. We are withdrawing that particular request. So I'll cover that in a minute.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, Mr. Peterson, please continue.
Where is this? If this next page is just simply the history of the general fund transfers. The first one was in 2002. Then in 2006, there was $6 million, 2008, $6 million, 2009, $3.5 million, and 2010, $1.5 million, and this year it's $1.5 million. That's simply just a graphic explanation of all those funds being taken out of the construction fund.
Above there.
So that.
Let's see. What was that?
Then the next one is on the surcharge, what the what the surcharge will bring in if it is if you do renew it, the $1.2 million that just says it will be losing $1.2 million in annual revenue. But the going back to Senator Howe's question,
Mr. Peterson, sorry, and I appreciate you going back to Senator Howe. I'm just trying to match up your slides here. So two slides ago, we talked about an extension of the $5 surcharge. In this, you call it a surcharge increase of $450.
I'm sorry.
Are we on, We're on a different one?
No. Mr. Chair, members, the surcharge really is $450, and that's my mistake for not making it more clear. There already is a 50-cent charge that goes to local municipalities for their work. And so we're so it's a $5. There is a $5 charge. We're only increasing it $450. As of 2 years, as of a year ago, we only increased it $450. It's just simply easier to talk about in terms of $5.
So those who are paying it are paying $5.
They're paying $5. They would have been paying 50 cents before.
Okay, members, is that clear? Senator Kielash is giving me a nod, at least. Okay, continue, Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, members, I apologize for not making that clear. This page is, we had in our original budget request on pages 10 and 11, we had requested some fee adjustments that would have amounted to around $2.1 million. Those were affecting the electrical inspectors, plumbing inspectors, and elevator inspectors. That one of the goals of that was to properly ensure that everybody's paying for the services that were provided for them. But the other one was to increase revenue. We don't believe we need that revenue. So the governor's has withdrawn that fee increase request. We call it a fee adjustment, but it's a fee increase request. So in total, there would have been some reductions, but for the most part, it would have been an increase. So we're just simply withdrawing it. We think the construction activity will pick up some, and we don't believe we need it. If we have the surcharge, we do not believe we need this. This was submitted as part of the department's original budget last summer, and over the last few weeks, we've been looking at it very closely, and I just don't think we need it. I don't want to charge people any more money than they need to pay.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Please continue.
And that, oh, I'm sorry. One more. The final one, number of small issues. Last year, there was a major restructuring of the law, the statutes affecting the construction code area, and a major overhaul. There was a revenue neutral. Since that time, industry groups, as well as, in one case, additional legislation, has prompted a need to go back and just sort of clean it up. And with what amounts to some pretty small changes, the total of $68,000 in 2012 and $31,000 in 2013. And those are, each one is a comparatively small one. The first, medical gas and vacuum. Those are for things like oxygen used in medical areas for handling the pipes or the tubes, and that'd be licensing. Right now, they're being licensed at $35 a year. This would just change that to $40 every 2 years. This was passed after we had passed our the other bill last year. The continuing education area. Is some continuing education sponsors are charged a fee, some aren't. This just evens that out, and it amounts to $11,000 in 2012 and $7,000 in 2013. Signed contractor bond registration fee. People who install billboards in cities have two choices. One is they have to get a bond in each community, or they can get a statewide bond. Through an oversight in the drafting last year, we did not include the statewide bond. So we want to include the statewide bond to enable a signed contractor to not have to go to the municipality. Instead, the signed contractor just come to the state, get a bond, and be able to put up their billboards in any of the municipalities in the state, their governing bodies. The pipe laying bond filing fee, the next one, is simply allowing pipe layers to purchase a bond to perform to lay the pipes from the main water mains to the house or to commercial contract, to commercial businesses and that sort of thing. Just simply to allow them to get a bond. And the final one is a backflow prevention tester registration. This does two things. It sets up a fee, license, or registration, which you pay a fee so we can keep track of people who are backflow prevention testers, and requires them to put a tag on the facility they test. You're now required for commercial buildings in these areas, or for hospitals, medical facilities, are required to have these things tested once a year. And so this simply requires those people to be registered, and then they put a tag on it. Once, so then you can go and look at that tag and find out who did the testing and make sure that it was done correctly. And with that, Mr. Chairman, that completes our change items as well as my review of the budget.
Senator DeCraig.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I have a question on that last one. This fee is for an inspector that's going to be inspecting these. Just as a for instance, I own a campground, and we're required to have a backflow preventer on every spigot. And how will this affect, that? Will a campground owner be able to do this? Will it have to be a licensed plumber that pays this fee, that submits this report?
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator DeCreef, Cecilia Jackson, our CFO, will answer the question.
Morning. Morning. Mr. Chairman, Senator, I can't see your name.
DeCreef.
On the backflow prevention tester registration, there are two pieces to it. One is if you are currently a licensed plumber, you get the registration so that you can also do the rebuilding of these instruments. If you are a tester, you do not necessarily need to be a licensed plumber. You can then be registered. So there's a difference. And then with the registration, if you're a non-plumber, you can do the inspection on an annual basis. But every 5 years, the units themselves need to be opened up and rebuilt and then put back together. There you need a licensed plumber.
Senator DeCreef.
Thank you, Chairman. Could you get me some more information on that and how that plays out into the real world other than the hospitals and, the large companies like that, how this plays out in the resort industry and other parts of business in Minnesota?
Certainly.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, yes, we will.
Now, this is a new fee, am I correct?
This is, yes.
So, Senator Cohen.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, I just want to follow up on Senator Lilly's question relative to the FTE. So that's encompassed with the withdrawal of the construction fee?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cohen.
Yes. Think you went,
yes.
Okay.
Mr. Peterson, can I ask you to move the microphone? Thank you. You're blocking your PowerPoint there.
I apologize.
No problem.
But you can't see anyway.
Senator Cohen, did you have your question answered?
Yeah.
Okay. Senator Tomasoni.
Can I follow up on that also? So we have this $5 minimum fixed rate building permit surcharge, and then we have the chart of the withdrawals to help balance the general fund, and then the $2.2 million adjustment. Are any of those related? Are they all different fees? Or?
No. Mr. Chairman, Senator Tomasoni, the forecast, the third page, which you referred to, the $2.2 million, we had proposed an additional fees. We're withdrawing that request. So that's not related. The other two are related to $4.50 or $5 surcharge that we discussed earlier. The other two sheets are related to that. Does that answer your question?
So this the $2.2 million fee is not the same fee as the other one?
No. As far as we're concerned, it'd be a mistake to adopt that. We don't think we need it. We think the construction activity is increasing not as fast as we'd like, but it is increasing, so we don't think we necessarily need it to provide the services that the state needs.
So, Commissioner Peterson, I don't know if you can summarize this. So you have a 5% reduction, and you have a series of fees. Can you tell me, can you give us some numbers for each of those? In other words, what are you saving with the 5% reduction, and then how much money are you bringing in with these various fees?
The 5%, remember, the fees cannot be used for the area where we're doing the 5% reduction. The fees can only be used in the construction area, the construction licensing and permitting area. We are proposing reduction in the labor standards area for $43,000 a year.
Right.
So that will, the consequence of that will be one half less person. That's and be answer a few phone calls or something. It'll maybe take a little bit longer to respond to people than we'd like to.
Yeah, probably.
The other thing that we are requesting is an extension of the existing surcharge that would go on top of the 50-cent fee the municipalities pay now, and that additional surcharge is $4.50. So it's a total of a $5 surcharge that would go to the construction code and licensing area to help replace the funds which are taken out of this fund that goes to it's allocated to the general fund of $1.5 million. And then our final one is a number of the small increase we just finished discussing.
And so let me try again, Mr. Peterson. How much are you raising in fees this year? With this proposal, how much money are you bringing in new fee revenue?
The only new fee revenue we'll be bringing in, if you can, be $68,000 in new fee revenue will be all that's added on. There'll be an addition. If you continue the $1.2 million surcharge that was instituted in 2010, then if you call that an increase, I don't call it an increase because you're already spending it. But we are asking it for it to be renewed. So that would be $1.268,000.
Mr. Jensen, you had a little more.
Well, Mr. Chair.
That was responsive, Mr. Peterson. I don't mean that. But Mr. Jensen might be able to help us, too.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct from what I'm tracking. But my question is, what does this do to the fund balance, and do they have enough money over the next 2 years to operate the expenses from this fund?
Mr. Peterson, did you catch that?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Jensen, members, we'd like to keep a fund balance. The MMB recommends that in this area, for the construction codes section, that we do keep a $5 million fund balance. We have about a total of this next year, if the $1.2 million surcharge is granted, the extension is granted, we will have somewhere around $25 million revenues coming in each year. They do recommend you keep about an 18 to 20% reserve to handle the ups and downs of the permitting process. Like right now, we're getting a lot of money in as people start the spring construction season. However, that'll drop off considerably in October and November when the people are winding down. So you do need a fund balance, and that's why we like to have a certain amount left, and we think it's sufficient. If we had kept the fees that we had earlier proposed, it would be substantially higher.
Mr. Jensen, did you have is that helpful?
Mr. Chairman, yes, that's fine.
Members, other questions? Mr. Peterson has successfully made it through his PowerPoint. We have the budget books in front of us. Senator Metzen, Senator Tomasoni, you've been through these budget pages before. Anything more as a follow-up while we have Mr. Peterson with us?
I don't have any. No, Mr. Chairman, no.
I was going to ask Senator Cohen if he felt we'd gone beyond eighth grade, but he's already left, so I'm going to assume we have, Mr. Peterson. I appreciate you walking this through with us. Members, anything else for the Department of Labor and Industry at this time? If not, then the committee's adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.